Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Business and Transportation Committee. We have three bills to take up today. I guess there were four. Anyway, I think there's agreement on most of these, but we'll see. Patrick, I think we're going to start with opening a public hearing. Actually, we do need a public hearing. Public hearing on House Bill 4104A. So we'll open that, and Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4104A comes to us from the House with a floor vote of 43-14. The measure deletes limiting interim medical benefits for certain types of services, requires health benefit plans to expedite pre-authorizations and guarantee payment of expenses for medical services provided prior to the acceptance or denial of claims according to terms, conditions, and benefits of plan. And it goes on for a while, Mr. Chair. It's on OLIS. The SMS on OLIS members have had a chance to review it. Perhaps I'll just let Representative Holvey describe it.
Representative Holvey. And Mary Botkin, if you're here as well, where are you? You're the only one signed up, so.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 4104. I appreciate your indulgence to listen to me for a few minutes. I'll try to pick up where Patrick left off. This bill was a result of interim hearings that we had in the House Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency Committee, and then the bill was actually heard and passed out of the Business and Labor Committee on the House side. So I've been working diligently with stakeholders on this bill since November and trying to fix a particular issue that we became aware of and that I've heard stories about in the past. The issue involves the interim benefit period under a workers' comp claim, which is the period before the determination of the comp claim is made. So currently, and it specifically addresses the issue when somebody has a health insurance through a health plan and a comp claim. So the problem that we were seeing is that workers were waiting for a determination, and sometimes the determination takes a while, and all of a sudden they don't have health insurance anymore, gets denied. And they weren't covered. They never got treatment to correct whatever injury or illness they might have had. They don't get back to work, and they never get treatment because they lose their health benefits at the same time. We did a little bit of research, went back to 2001, and Chair Beyer, you might remember Senate Bill 4. I think it was 485 in 2001, carried, it was a bill from Gene Durfer, I believe, that was meant to address this specific issue. And come to find out that the way the bill was drafted, that it really didn't address this issue, and that workers were the ones that were losing out on benefits that they should have. It's sort of a situation was, they should be covered because they have a health plan and workers' comp coverage, and it's just a matter of who pays. And in the process of the carriers trying to decide who pays and whether, waiting for those determinations, the worker loses out on the treatment and never does get the treatment sometimes, and it just seemed that needed to be fixed. And so that's kind of what led us to this particular bill. The bill essentially, going from memory, I guess, it expedites the pre-authorization during this interim benefit period by the health plan to get the worker the treatment, and then they're going to work out the details with the comp carrier, at the end of the day about who pays how much and work out those decisions. It also is sort of telling that workers will, look at this scenario and they will go, gee, I'm not going to file a comp claim because I'm not sure I'm going to get coverage. I'm just going to file this under my health plan and get coverage. Providers, on the other hand, are going, well, we're not really sure we're going to get paid through a comp claim. We have no assurance of that, so we really don't want to file a comp claim. We'll file for you under your health plan, but kind of leading you away from the comp claim. And so I think the result of this bill in clarifying this scenario and making sure that workers get that treatment is really a win-win-win for the everybody involved, where the insurance company, insurance plans perhaps on the health plan side may be actually covering claims that should be comp claims as a result of the lack of assurance from providers and the lack of certainty for workers as to where they're going to file their claim. And on the flip side, the worker comp claim, which is worker comp division, which is largely funded by payments through employers, is going to get treatment to the workers, get them back to work quicker, so it's a win for them too. And this the other piece is the workers themselves not getting caught in the middle of this uncertainty about who's going to pay for what, and so we don't get treatment until that's all settled out. That was what the original Senate Bill 485 was supposed to fix. I don't know that this bill totally fixes everything in the worker comp arena. It wasn't meant to. It's just about this specific issue. As I've mentioned, we've had Regents, Providence, the OMA, SAFE, the agencies, all involved in these discussions, and the self-insured association, I think, all involved in these discussions, and I believe everybody is in agreement with this bill. The agencies are behind us to answer some really technical questions if you have some that I can't answer correctly, and hopefully if I answer something incorrectly, they will stand up and come forward and correct me. Because workers' comp is sometimes, as I've described this, seems pretty basic, pretty simple, but the nuts and bolts of it can be kind of complex. And I really appreciate all of the stakeholders helping us solve this particular issue. I think everybody sees this as a good bill. It did pass MLAC last Friday unanimously with the Dash 4 amendment, which I am suggesting that you put in the bill. The Dash 4 amendment makes a change that helps the insurance industry that came from at Regents through John Powell, and I really appreciate their work and making sure their issues were addressed, and also an issue for a final issue for SAFE, which I'm guessing is probably the reason for some of the no votes on the House side, because there was still this sense that there was a couple of language tweaks that needed to be done, though all the stakeholders agreed with the concept, and I think we've got a good bill before you today. So I appreciate you moving this forward and taking it to the floor, because I think this does help all the industry, the employers, the workers, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions that I can.
Anybody got any deep technical questions for Representative Bowlby? We've got a whole audience behind him that would correct him. Don't see any. Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mary Botkin with AFSCME, Council 75. This bill was brought forward on behalf of our members who were being injured and were not filing. We're not getting the necessary medical treatment they needed to get. This bill fills that gap. I have every confidence that DCBS and the Workers' Comp Division are going to be able to administer this very easily, and if not easily, at least well. And it solves a problem that we were looking for, which was to make sure that workers were getting prompt and adequate medical treatment when they were injured. And with that, I want to thank Representative Holvey for introducing the bill and urge you to vote yes and just move it along its way. It's been through many, many, many changes, and it's had a lot of scrutiny in the House. So MLAC likes it now. We like it now. As Representative Holvey says, workers' comp, it's never easy. Those of us who've been around for a while know that. And we think this fixes it. So I appreciate it, and I, too, am happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Any questions for Mary?
I guess I just have.
Chuck?
World, if somebody has a workers' comp claim, you take them to the hospital or doctor, they file a workers' comp claim, and they're taken care of within the system. Is there other business world, other things that happen? Is it not a workers' comp claim? I mean, because if it's a workers' comp claim, they're taken care of. So what are you trying to fix? I think I understand it, but is it because it's questionable that it's a workers' comp claim when they go, and so they're not really sure that I'm not.
The state is a self-insured employer.
Right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson.
Okay.
The state is a self-insured employer through PEB, and they're not always prompt in their determinations, and sometimes it can take a little longer than it does in the private sector, and we're just trying to encourage them to move quicker.
Okay.
And in the process, I want to make sure that folks who have health care coverage get the treatment that they need either through their health care carrier or through the workers' comp system. And, you know, let the insurance companies figure out who's supposed to pay and let them fight it out rather than postponing treatment of the worker.
And to follow up, Senator Thompson, I think that sometimes a worker comp claim isn't all as clear as somebody falling off the roof and hurting themselves going to the hospital, you know.
Ladders. I do ladders.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, falling off ladders. Yeah. I've been there, too.
Yeah.
So I've done both those things in my past. So sometimes it's not clear as clear, and, you know, they have independent medical examinations and, you know, all sorts of process to go through to determine whether it's an accepted claim or denied claim. And this bill's about if a worker during that time period also has a health plan, while they're waiting for that determination, to go ahead and get the expedited pre-authorization under their medical health plan to get treatment. And if, in fact, it's an accepted claim, the workers' comp system then reimburses the health plan and the providers for any of those expenses during the interim benefit period. And if the claim is denied, then you would suspect that they would be covered under their health plan, but it's, you know, then it's on the health plan to treat the worker.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, Senator Stark.
Thank you. Mary, you mentioned the state. This bill, though, infects private employers, private insurance as well, correct? Okay, just making sure. Thank you.
Any others? Well, you're the only two signed up to testify. Well, only one of you signed up. So so we've got a virtual love fest here. Is there anybody else? Thank you both very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify?
Seeing none, we will close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 4104A. We have a dash 4 amendment. Would you like to do it?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 4104.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 4104. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion?
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, it's a dash A4.
A4, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
There is none, so the
A was implied.
The A4 amendments are adopted, to be clear. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended by the dash A4 amendments to the Senate for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 4104 as amended by the A4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr?
No discussion necessarily toward the bill itself, just to note that when this bill came across the House, there was a couple of people that testified in the House committee, and there was a couple of people that testified in the Senate committee, and none of them submitted written testimonies that we can put on the record that shows up on OLIS. And just, you know, if we have a room full of folks, that is helpful for legislators. They have that testimony posted, and it's also helpful for the public to see the arguments for and against legislation. So it's not pro or con on the bill, it's just kind of a
for the good of the system.
I was really surprised because I looked on here and there's like there's no testimony posted. So
alrighty, and I will note this is something that we've been trying to deal with for a long time. I thought Senator Durfler and I addressed this 10-12 years ago, but apparently not. So let's see, is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion?
Senate bill. Did I already move this to the floor? Did you throw me off guard? I did.
This is the most going to the floor. This is the last thing we have to vote on.
The last time. Is there any opposition? All right. Then we will House Bill 4104A, as amended by the A4s, is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Edwards, would you also carry this one?
Sure.
Senator Edwards will carry. All right, we will close on that, and we will...
Can we do 4040 next?
Okay. We have
members in the room for both of them.
For both of them. Yeah. Who was here first?
The list for 4040 is shorter, so I would suggest doing that. There's three people on this one and seven people on that one. So.
All right, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4040A. Patrick?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4040A requires the Oregon State Lottery to balance its obligation to maximize net revenues with its obligation to serve the public good. Requires the Lottery Commission to adopt comprehensive responsible gaming policy that integrates consideration, responsible playing of games, and chance into lottery operations. Requires annual reporting to the Legislative Assembly. We have, as well as that, two amendments. We have a -4 amendment, which deletes the reporting requirement, specifies neither the measure nor the requirement in ORS 461-200, or the state lottery achieve the mission of maximizing net revenue commensurate with public good, can cause the state of Oregon, the Oregon State Lottery, or lottery game retailers to be liable. With that amendment, the -A4, we also have a -A6 amendment, which we just got about an hour ago, so I believe we've met the one-hour requirement. Proposal NOLIS, that one eliminates authority for the Lottery Commission to determine by rule procedure for garnishment of lottery winnings for persons with outstanding child support obligations, and then it specifies how a lottery winner's winnings would be used to pay out those obligations over time by statute, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you being willing to hear House Bill 4040. I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from House District 41. Thank you for hearing House Bill 4040 today regarding gambling. This is a bipartisan bill that passed the House floor with a bipartisan vote. Representative Kennemer and I, together with Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Parrish, have been working on problem gambling issues for several years. Gambling addiction is a very serious problem in our state. Over 80,000 Oregon adults are addicted to gambling. 90% of these are addicted to Oregon Video Lottery. The estimated social costs of problem gambling to Oregonians is over $500 million a year. We in the Human Services Committee heard many, many hours of testimony from Oregonians damaged by gambling addiction. And it's not just the gambler who is hurt. Families and employers suffer too. Individuals have destroyed marriages, lost their homes to foreclosure, devastated savings, lost their children, and bankrupt businesses. Gambling addiction is a hidden problem. It carries shame. We all know people, even in this building, who acknowledge that they have been addicted to alcohol or drugs. But few of us know people who acknowledge gambling addiction. It doesn't have the obvious signs like drug and alcohol addiction, like driving difficulties, slurred speech. It often comes to light only under criminal investigations like embezzlement or identity theft. We probably remember a woman who was a trusted employee at West Lynn City Hall who embezzled over $1 million. Another trusted employee in Estacada who embezzled over $2 million. Again, no outward signs of this addiction. I want to also thank Jack Roberts, the new lottery director, who invited him to be up here with me today, for his proactive approach to gambling problems. At his direction and under the leadership of Elisa DeZono, the chair of the Lottery Commission, the Lottery Administration is placing new focus on responsible gambling, with ads encouraging users to gamble responsibly, developing a code of conduct for employees and retailers, reestablishing working relationships with gambling experts, and many more. This bill seeks to support these efforts, and also by putting these policies into statute, House Bill 4040 will make sure that future administrations and legislators will continue this good work. Specifically, House Bill 4040A requires the Oregon Lottery Commission to adopt a comprehensive, responsible gaming policy with advice from stakeholders, including lottery employees, lottery retailers, mental health professionals, and others. The policy must include a code of practice, procedures to assure that decision makers consider the best available research about the effects lottery games and marketing have on vulnerable population. Also, strategies to minimize the risk of harm to vulnerable individuals. This bill requires the Oregon Lottery and the Oregon Health Authority to jointly report to the legislature each year about responsible and problem gambling data and activities. I'm fine with the -4 amendment, which answers issues raised by the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association by clearly stating that there is no cause of action for liability against the state or retailer from an individual who might develop a gambling problem, as a result of playing lottery games. Colleagues, these are important common sense policies. You probably saw the Oregonian series of articles about the destructive impacts state-sponsored gambling has on the lives of many Oregonians. Most gambling addicts aren't the well-dressed, fun-loving couples that we often see on TV ads. They aren't the people who take a weekend trip to the Indian casinos. Stop by your neighborhood mini casino, the Dotties, or the Foxies, on the corner of your community, and you'll find the lonely middle-aged woman at 11 in the morning. You will find the desperate unemployed laborer trying to win back the rent money. As legislators, we are charged with overseeing state government. We've already decided that gambling can be offered in neighborhood restaurants, bars, and those little mini casinos. People from all over the state have written me with their personal stories of tragedy and loss. We need to recognize the harm that state-sponsored gambling can bring to vulnerable Oregonians. This bill with the -4 amendment is an important statement from us, the legislature, that we are aware of the impacts that gambling addictions may have, and we need to encourage responsible gambling as our state. And I'd ask you to please pass 4040A with the -4 amendment to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Thank you, and I've invited Jack Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Lottery. And our position formally on this is that we're neutral. And the reason why we're neutral is that it basically would mandate us to do what we're already doing. And so from our standpoint, we believe we're moving ahead in the direction that Representative Tomei said. But I wanted to be here particularly because Representative Tomei has really also reached out to us as the lottery, including our chair, Lisa DiZono. And I've met with Representative Tomei several times to try to work through this and make it consistent with what our efforts are and what we share as a commitment to try to deal with problem gambling and with gambling addiction. Our view is maybe a little bit different than Representative Tomei's in terms of the role that the lottery plays in the state, but we're absolutely in agreement that the terrible stories that we all have heard about, read about, and in some cases have known people affected by problem gambling and gambling addiction, that those are issues that we have a responsibility to address. And we think that the provisions of this, by in effect mandating what we've already committed to do, is something that we're comfortable with if you decide to pass that. I would say about the -4 amendments, there have been concerns raised about whether by setting this standard we could result unwittingly in giving a basis for people to sue the state, including the lottery, or to sue retailers. And we wanted to make it clear, and I think the Dashboard Amendment helps with that, making it clear that is not something that's intended by this bill. It would also help if the bill goes to the floor to have some legislative history in that regard, and we'd hope we could work with the carrier of the bill to make that clear. Finally, the Dashboard Amendment also, as I understand it, removes the reporting requirement that's in the bill. There is some reason for that too, since a lot of the information that's being requested there is not currently available, and that's why Representative Tomei, at my request in the House, added the language "if available." But in addition to that, by requiring annual reports in perpetuity, it could raise some questions as to whether or not we have to go back and change legislation if it turns out that other information is more appropriate, or if there's some need either to revise that or if in the future to eliminate that. The commitment that I'm prepared to make today is that whether this bill passes at all or whether it passes with the Dash-4 amendments and so it removes that reporting requirement, we remain ready to report annually or at whatever terms the legislature asks on whatever information it requests that we have available and that we can ascertain. Our goal is to be cooperative with the legislature in trying to help us all meet our requirements under the law, which does include the critical funding that we provide for vital state services, including education, economic development, and environmental stewardship. But it also is a requirement that we understand and recognize the problems that some people have with gambling and their inability to responsibly gamble, and we're going to do what we can to help enforce the good practices that we have learned about to date and that we continue to study and try to learn about and to work collaboratively with the state so that we can have a balanced and responsible program.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Perry?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. We obviously had some concerns with the underlying bill of 4040 as it relates to if you have general policies that an agency is supposed to meet. Obviously, it's up to their discretion to decide how to meet those. As you start to get into specific things you want them to meet, you open up what's called, I believe it's a statutory case of cause. When you start talking about addiction treatment, stuff like that, it opens up a window for liability. And so we have seen the Dash-4 amendments. We think the Dash-4 amendments help address that issue. So I think if it is the committee's intent to move the bill forward, we would hope and appreciate that you could add the Dash-4 amendments. Now, what I've passed along, and for Senator Starr, I believe we sent this electronically, but you know I'm not an expert. So if this didn't come on electronically to put on OLIS, I can make sure that that happens at a later date. One of the things I wanted to say is I do think that the lottery has happened in a responsible manner. I think the employees over there and past lottery commissioners have done a very good job trying to balance everything. I know there are a lot of people that don't like the fact that the state's in the gaming business, and I understand that position, but we are. And so on the back of the sheet of paper, there's a graph of the forecast. And basically, if you look, the lottery is not meeting the current forecast. It is basically, and because of the sales, it is. You look at the future forecast, which is that blue line, they're not intended to meet it at this point in time. Now, obviously, that can all change from biennium to biennium. We know that. But I think one of the reasons you do is if you look at the other graph on the sheet of paper, The fourth column over shows that lottery retailers in the last 4 years have declined. So you are getting a declining retailer base in the state of Oregon. Now, the next column over talks about liquor licenses that could apply for the lottery. They are increasing. So more people could be lottery retailers, but less people are choosing to. So you've got a declining retailer base. In the second graph, it talks about how much sales the lottery is doing. And it's growing at about 1.5% a year. But if you look at all comparative standards, food and beverage, GDP, other gaming in Oregon, they're all increasing at 5% a year. So, you know, if you're really looking at it from a maximizing revenue standpoint only, which I think a lot of people portrayed this as, they're not doing their job. But I would argue I think they're trying their best to balance everything as it moves forward. And remember also when you look at that, the only form that addiction treatment is getting their money is from the lottery. They're not getting it from anywhere else. So as that market share declines and gaming continues to increase in the state of Oregon, then the gaming addiction as a percentage is going to decline. So I guess my point is I'm not sure we need the bill from my vantage point. If you guys feel as a policymakers you need the bill, I would hope and pray that you add the Section 4, but I think the lottery has been acting responsibly in all facets that we can see. You know, it's gaming. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that don't like gaming, and there's negative byproducts of gaming, which we've always been supportive of gaming addiction treatment, gaming addiction money. And I would say the lottery used to do the gaming addiction money. A court case took it away from them. Then there was a legal opinion that took away their advertising for gaming addiction. So I think the history has shown that the lottery has been acting responsibly in many ways in this. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think we've probably been a little inconsistent at the legislature. There's the dedicated 1%. We keep taking that money away in the Ways and Means process. Yeah. Questions of Mr. Perry? Seeing none, thank you very much, Bill. That's all I have signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Don't see anybody. So we'll close the hearing on House Bill 4040, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4126A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4126A comes to us with a House vote of 60-0. It allows consumer-owned utilities to use certain amounts of unbundled renewable energy certificates to meet the renewable portfolio standard under certain circumstances. It directs the Public Utility Commission to study the impact of allowing electric companies to offer voluntary renewable energy tariffs to non-residential customers and to use the results of the study to determine whether and under what conditions it is reasonable and in the public interest to allow electric companies to do so. It authorizes the use of such tariffs upon determination by the Commission to do so. It specifies that all costs associated with the tariffs are to be borne by non-residential customer receiving services under the tariff. We have no amendment currently under this measure. The measure comes to us with a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome. Good Representative up. Smith, I understand you achieved a compromise with people, so let's hear about it.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which is the Columbia River Basin in Northeast Oregon. This afternoon, I'm here to introduce House Bill 4126. And what I want to share with you is that this represents a consensus reached after a long, robust, deliberative, and sometimes very difficult set of negotiations. This work came about as a result of the leadership of our governor, Governor Kitzhaber, and I want to thank him for that and thank Margie for all the assistance that she has brought to the table. Participants in this conversation included Umatilla Electric Cooperative, Central Electric Cooperative, Renewable Northwest Project, the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, of which one of my co-ops, Columbia Basin, is a member, along with the Oregon Trail Electric Cooperative is a member, the Citizen Utility Board of Oregon, Pacific Core, Portland General Electric, Eugene Water and Electric Board, Idaho Power, the Northwest Energy Coalition, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association, again, which City of Milton Freewater and the City of Hermiston are members, Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon Department of Energy, the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. All of these folks were around the table. In addition to that, the Morrow County Judge was around the table. Mr. Chair, colleagues, House Bill 4126 does three things. First, it addresses concerns raised about the application of the RPS. Two, it allows following PUC review and approval for additional flexibility for the sale of green power to certain customers by investor-owned utilities. And three, it alleviates efforts to modify the renewable portfolio standard beyond the scope of what's contained in this legislation. I would respectfully request your passage of this. I would share with the committee that this bill passed 60-0 in the House, and really appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Representative. Margie?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I'm Governor John Kitzhaber's Energy Policy Advisor. In respect of time, just want to echo what Representative Greg Smith said. We were very happy to participate in the task force to look at the renewable portfolio standard and any changes that we may need to make to adapt to changing climate and economic environment. So strongly encourage you to support the bill. Thank you for your help.
Thank you, sir.
So, Mr. Chair, if it would be all right, I brought Legislative Council just in case there is any questions for me.
Okay.
But we have Werner Seaman, Craig Campbell, and Scott Bolton who could do a much better job explaining the legislation to the committee.
All righty. We'll go with that then.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, Seaman, and Bolton. Welcome, gentlemen.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative in support of the bill. I'll keep my comments fairly brief. This bill, at least the portion that addresses an issue that was raised by Umatilla Electric Cooperative, is addressed in Section 2 of the bill. You'll find my written testimony on OLIS. I know that will thrill Senator Starr, so you have the opportunity to read that at your leisure.
Everyone from here on in is going to mention it, I'm sure.
the issue that Umatilla Electric Cooperative is addressing is Umatilla Electric Cooperative is a small utility with 2% of the statewide sales of energy. However, because of the introduction of server farms in our operating territory, we are looking at raising above the 3% threshold, which makes us a large utility under the renewable portfolio standard. As we only have 10,000 customers, and because we're a customer-owned utility, our business model is such that we end up having to spread a rather large overtime cost of the renewable portfolio standard over a relatively small number of consumers. What this bill does is it gives us some adapting tools between now and 2038 where we're able to use unbundled RECs for a longer period of time and for a larger percentage of our obligation under the RPS to help transition that load until we finally meet our ultimate obligation of 25% of the renewable portfolio standard in approximately 2038, at which time we join the rest of the state large utilities in only being able to use 20% of the unbundled RECs at that point in time. So from our perspective, this helps us facilitate what was an unforeseen challenge under the RPS, and I think it does it in a very elegant way. And I want to reemphasize how rare it is to have an opportunity to work with a large number of folks who, although they may have different interests, we were able to come together and through some rather contentious discussion, come up with a workable solution. I want to thank the members of the task force who worked with us to achieve that solution.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Werner Seaman. I work as the policy director for Renewable Northwest Project. We're a four-state advocacy organization that promotes additional renewable energy and the development of new renewable energy here in the Pacific Northwest. We've been doing so for about 20 years, and in fact, next week are celebrating our 20th anniversary. I want to also thank members of the task force for the work that we did. I think Mr. Campbell said it right, that it was some good work. It was a difficult compromise and at times contentious. I want to say we weren't particularly excited to come into the conversation in the beginning. I think that folks are generally aware that the context was that there was a potentially facing a ballot measure, and our understanding is that this compromise alleviates the need to have a ballot measure going forward. With that said, through the conversation and through hearing the concerns raised by the folks at Oregon Rural Electric Co-ops Association, at Umatilla Electric and Central Oregon Electric Co-op. We did feel that it was appropriate to make some modifications to the existing renewable portfolio standard that Mr. Campbell just outlined to give some additional flexibility in terms of how electrical co-ops that are experiencing significant amounts of load growth, to give them a way to comply with the renewable portfolio standard in a way that was the need for which was really unforeseen, we believe, at the point that we passed the renewable portfolio standard several years ago. So we feel that that's a reasonable compromise given the circumstances that those utilities were facing. At the same time, the other part of this package that allows the investor-owned utilities to establish a green tariff, we believe, is a potential way that we're going to grow some additional market for renewable energy. And I think that one of the things that we were very surprised to see through this process and the conversation that took place over the last several months, really, is that there are a number of businesses that are looking to come to the state of Oregon and are looking to locate here. And the existing very low carbon and including largely the base of our hydropower resources in the state, which give us an advantage in terms of what our carbon emissions are for the state, and development of new renewables through a new renewable portfolio standard, and then hopefully additional new renewables through a green tariff product for customers and investor-owned utilities. We've seen that really as we go forward, especially for attracting high-tech and new businesses to the state, that renewable energy and low-carbon energy is, we believe, and we think that we saw through the task force process, an actual competitive advantage for the state of Oregon to be able to provide that type of electricity to customers who are looking for the types of energy that we have and that we're continuing to develop in the state. So again, this was a compromise. I think it was difficult work, but I think it was a good product, and I want to thank members of the task force, and please ask you to support this compromise and vote yes on 4126. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. Pacific Power serves about 550,000 customers across Oregon, from northeast Portland to many rural corners of our state. We have assets or customers in 31 of the state's 36 counties, making us the largest rural electric provider in the state. We also support House Bill 4126A. I'll be brief and just build upon the comments of my colleagues by essentially saying that this policy for us reflects listening to consumers and listening to those businesses who are seeking to look at Oregon as a place to do business and invest, hopefully in the rural parts of our state. This legislation helps preserve Oregon's renewable energy policy while also establishing a process, and what we believe will be a robust process at the Oregon Public Utility Commission, who helped us craft portions of this bill to examine the idea of a green tariff, as Administrator Brennan laid out in introducing the bill. There's quite a bit of parameter around what that examination will take and what a green tariff will likely be. And the key words to that will be it's a voluntary product, and it's one that whose costs will be borne by those who take advantage of it. This legislation makes clear that a green tariff can coexist with the state's current direct access laws and allow Oregon, frankly, to join a growing number of other states who are establishing the green tariff as an economic development tool for those businesses seeking to invest in cleaner resources. So be happy to take any questions. Hope that you'll support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right.
Did you have a question?
All right. So I have signed up Mike Herrmann. Let's just go through Tom Hammer. Let's try that to start with. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name for the record, I'm Mike Nierman. I'm a volunteer with Oregon Citizens Lobby, and I think you have some other people that are going to testify on some of the guts of this. I think you have the you have my testimony, written testimony there. One of the things I want to do is just connect some dots for you. And so what we have is we have in 2007, we had the renewable power standards were passed, and with that, it defined out large-scale hydroelectric power as not being renewable power. Since that was baked into the cake, what happened with Umatilla Electric Company was inevitable, that sooner or later you were going to bonk against that problem there, and that's what happened. And so that's what caused the ballot measure to the IP3 to come into existence, was the fact that it was unacceptable for Umatilla Electric Power Company to have to bear that burden there. I circulated that petition. I have to say that I circulate a lot of petitions. I'm kind of a little bit of a petition guy. That petition was one of the easiest petitions I've ever circulated. It was a little bit hard to explain because you got to do the 25% and 3% and all this kind of stuff. But once I got it explained, I'd never had any problem getting anyone to sign that petition. It's simply nonsensical to people to say that large-scale hydroelectric power is not renewable power, and that's what the problem is here. And I'm just I'm a little bit upset that that what this was it looks to me like there was a backroom deal done to squish this petition. And so I just want to be on the record saying that I'm a little bit upset about that. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Beyer. Vice Chair Starr, thank you for the correspondence and committee. I'm Tom Hammer, Yamhill County resident, chief petitioner, one of two chief petitioners for Initiative Petition 3, which has been described. I'm here to speak in opposition to 4126A. It was written to kill the petition, which would have returned hydropower to renewable energy status. Does anyone really believe that hydropower is not renewable? The wind blows, the sun glows, and the river flows. They're all renewable. You go with a false premise, you get problems. You get unintended consequences. 4126 is the first of many fixes. I've had conversations with two senators on this. One senator from the urban area of Oregon, another from a rural area. Different constituencies they respond to. I've been acquainted with the first senator for two decades. Her constituents are my old neighbors. They enjoy altruistic causes, including the ecological movement. The second senator spoke for business. He told me it was a shame that free market for electricity had been, quote, corrupted, unquote, by huge subsidies for inefficient power. But now he had constituents who had acted on incentives to invest in subsidized power, and they, of course, needed the system to be protected. 4126 is not a bill that's good business. It's good crony capitalism, and that we don't need that. a tyrannical government is required for crony capitalism, corporatism, to succeed. A tyrannical government fears a vote of the people. We have such a government in Oregon, and it needs to end. The 1 million honest, hardworking Oregonians who can't be here to testify because they're working, raising their kids, caring for the elderly, and not burdening you with their beliefs, they need a vote. They don't need to be shoved aside. So it's pretty clear if you vote yes on 4126, you will satisfy those for whom ecology is a religion, and you'll take care of crony capitalists. I hope you have the courage to think of those million that can't be here, and that we stop taking our bedrock population for granted. I'll entertain any questions, comments.
Thank you, sir. Questions of this panel? Senator Starr?
So I appreciate both of you being here today. Is there a reason why the initiative would have to stop? I mean, if the initiative's out there getting signatures now, why would you necessarily stop?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, it's not stopped. It's not stopped until the chief petitioner signs a release. That hadn't happened. So it's not stopped. The reason that the task force was convened to create 4126A was because the signature gathering was going so well that it actually presented a threat. So it's alive and well and still has good steam. please allow it to continue, sir.
This bill doesn't in any way preempt a citizen's opportunity to continue to gather signatures on initiative, does it?
This bill does not do that.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair, no, it would not prevent the gathering of signatures to continue, but without, I don't know, about $125,000 to push it over the limit on signature gathering, and another pretty healthy chunk of change to make it successful on the ballot, it will die of a lack of money.
Let me be clear of my understanding, which may not be correct, but my understanding is that the only one who can withdraw the petition is the chief petitioners who started it. And I believe that Umatilla Electric was one of those, and there's another gentleman who was. And I believe what I've heard, and I can't confirm this, is that the chief petitioners believe that if this bill meets their needs, for whatever reason, and they have been willing to withdraw it if this bill passes. That's what I've heard.
Chair Beyer, I'm that other chief petitioner.
You're the other chief petitioner?
Yeah, I'm the other guy.
Okay.
It cannot go forward for practical reasons if 4126 passes.
Mr. Chairman,
my understanding, sir, is if you're the chief, I don't know you, if you're the chief petitioner, I think if you don't withdraw the petition, I mean, there's nothing to stop it.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct technically that this bill does not stop the gathering of the signatures for the petition, but it hurts us when the legislature takes actions that undermines the support for the petition, because I'm sure you know, it's tough to do a petition just with volunteers. And so when we have something going that's going in a positive direction, and then the legislature doesn't like the direction that's going, and then passes a bill that undermines the support for it, that's what we mean when we say that the petition is being killed.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Gerard?
Yeah, you're talking, I'm one of the people, I've done a petition. I was a chief petitioner. I've been on the ballot a couple times. So I'm trying to understand, and maybe we're just not getting it, but I agree with your premise that hydroelectric should be included as clean energy. I fully understand. I'm just having a real difficult time understanding why this bill interferes with that conclusion.
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, if the bill passes, the funding that will be necessary to continue the petition stops. So the only way to continue the petition is to leave things the way they were before 4126A was crafted.
That's not the legislature's decision. I mean, the money is a private concern. That's not our concern. We're not getting in the way of the funding.
Mr. Chairman, and
yes.
Senator Gerard, the technical nuts and bolts of what's going on is that Umatilla Electric Power Company right now produces 2.99999% of the energy. Once they go over the 3%, then they have to face the thresholds and the interim goals of the renewable power standards. So it puts them in a different ballpark there. What this bill does is this bill kind of rearranges a few of the carve-outs and all that. That makes it easier for them to not to meet those things. And just by their own testimony, it kicks the can down the road for them, not to 2025, but to 2038. So it takes them out that now all of a sudden they're not being hurt as a player in this, and so they're withdrawing their support for the initiative petition. That's the nuts and bolts of what's going on.
I agree with your analysis on signature gatherers, but there actually is a time when you can't withdraw the petition. I've faced that as well. So where we got the signatures and there's a kind of a drop dead date and you can't withdraw the petition. So that's by all means, I think you have a really good cause even without them, and I feel bad about undermining your funding, but this is kind of for us, we're looking for solutions, and this is better than what we started with, and so it's kind of a hard thing not to vote yes on. but I fully understand trying to get financing for initiatives. That is not easy, and I have a lot of empathy, and if you want somebody to sign on to your petition, I'll be happy to do it.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And let's see, Irene Gilbert and Greg Bass.
Senator Beyer, commission members, I'm Irene Gilbert from La Grande, Oregon, and I can respond a little bit to Senator Girard's comments. I did speak with Paul Cosgrove, who is one of the chief petitioners, and my question to him was, if this passes, what's going to happen? And he said he would be withdrawing the petition, and I said, well, does that mean that another group could pick up where you left off? And he said, no, you'd have to start all over. And I did confirm that with the Elections Division. And I also asked him what happened to the money in their account if this bill passes. And he said they would not transfer it to another group, anything that's left. They would refund it to the people who have donated, which if they're a nonprofit, I'm not sure how they can do that. But those were the answers that I got from both the Elections Division and from Paul Cosgrove.
Okay. I have a question.
Go ahead.
When you have chief petitioners, there's three chief petitioners. So you only have two. We had three. So I'm surprised that you could withdraw. I might be wrong, but I'm just surprised that you can withdraw without both parties agreeing that are chief petitioners.
I don't know. That was what he told me. I had not met the other gentleman until today.
Both of them. I think it takes both of them.
To withdraw? I would assume so.
Yeah. Anyway,
okay.
So again, I'm here to testify on this bill, and I came from La Grande, Oregon, and of course I gave you a big packet, and I know you were all looking forward to me reading to this to you, but since I have a grandchild that was born about an hour ago, I think I'm going to forego that and just kind of point out that the information in this is basically some data about the problems with the renewable energy standard, and I can tell you that I'm a researcher, and if any of you have any questions about any of the information here, I can tell you I can provide supporting documentation. There are major problems with the renewable energy standard. On to the bill specifically. I understand that the skids have been greased and that this bill is going to pass and that you're all going to vote for it. I do want to comment on it, and I believe that I represent some of the 70% plus people in the state of Oregon who believe that dam-created power should be counted as renewable. And one thing I did notice was that in the discussion of the people on the committee that drafted this bill, that group was notably missing. There was no one representing the 70 or 80% of the population out there that might disagree with that. The other issue was, and Barner commented on, the fact that we can draw in new manufacturers as a result of all of this new renewable energy. Well, if we had looked at renewable energy at the very beginning in 2007, this state was creating 80% of our energy, generating 80% of our energy from renewable sources. At that point, we should have been telling the whole world, we have cheap renewable energy, come here, build your manufacturing plants. Instead of that, we've developed this huge renewable energy umbrella, and we're creating a situation where ultimately our energy costs are going to go up, and we're still not going to be any better off than we were before. Now, I would have to say that House Bill 2146 really only exists to protect the renewable energy standard. And this standard is really just a vehicle that is used to justify taxpayer-supported financing of incentives to wind and solar. The problem is that, in effect, it's a veto of the initiative number 3. The petition. Pretending to resolve issues of a small utility should not justify the withdrawal of the hydropower initiative petition, which we all know the group has agreed to do if you pass this initiative. And it's a discredit to all of those who have been signing in the petition and obtaining signature. And it's, in my mind, an egregious example of political interference in the initiative process. I mean, the governor came to the group of people so that they could come up with a way to avoid having initiative number 3 pass. You all know that. Most of the people obtaining signatures and signing the petition don't care about how the renewable energy standard impacts Umatilla Electric Co-op or the other electric co-ops. The reason they're stating that they're signing is because they want to stop the hemorrhaging of state monies to support wind and solar developments in this state. Now, Oregon taxpayers are currently supporting 18 federal programs and an additional 21 state programs that are providing money to renewable energy. I went to the U.S. Department of Energy website and pulled up the list of incentives for wind energy and renewable energy and efficiency. I would have printed it for you, but it was 149 pages long, the ones that apply to this state of Oregon. I'd encourage you to take a look at it. Another group of signers are concerned about the impacts and the damages to our natural resource, including animals, views, and historical sites. You'll notice in some of the material that I provided to you that the Department of Defense is saying that some of these are providing a significant threat to our defense, to our national defense and national security. They're saying that they're impacting the ability of the Department of Navy flight pilots because they're impinging on their flight paths that they use for training new pilots. None of this seems to be mattering at the moment. Oregon taxpayers really care about the environment. Anyway, a lot of them that were signing the petition. And one thing that I brought, which I'd really like to have you take a look at, and this is in your packet. This is a picture provided by the Saddle Butte Wind Farm, which is currently being proposed. And what it shows is the currently existing and proposed wind farm surrounding the area that that wind farm is going to be built. If you look, it's virtually filling a huge part of Oregon. And my question is, where are the animals that are displaced by these wind farms supposed to be living? Where are the people that don't want to live around wind farms supposed to go? And how can we call areas wild and scenic that are completely surrounded by wind developments? So, at any rate, in the future, I would like to see you thinking about these things and the cumulative impacts of all these isolated little pieces of legislation that have a one-liner at the bottom that support you renewable energy and the renewable energy standard. And every time the people of this state get to a point where maybe we could quit paying for this, you pass some piece of legislation that circumvents it. Now, I did a calculation, and I was a teaching assistant for college-level statistics and statistic analysis. And I can tell you that I calculated out how much energy we would need to meet the renewable standard in 2025. And I based it on the increase in use of electricity and what was going to be required. And if we were counting every wind farm that's been developed and proposed in this state, we have already met the 25% standard for 2025. The problem is most of that energy is going out of state. And guess what? There's a one-liner that says if it's not used in Oregon, it doesn't count towards our renewable energy standard. There's another one-liner that says you can't consider need when you're approving these wind farms. There's nothing in there that requires these people to do a cost-benefit analysis to see if the people of the state are getting good benefit for their money. So, at any rate, the people in the state are tired of subsidizing wind energy that they view as is destroying our state. And you all know that this group as a body is not popular with the voters in this state. And this bill represents all that is wrong and dishonest with our political system. It addresses the desires of a few special interest groups and it totally ignores the desires of the bulk of the people who live in the state. So, I guess on that note, I will put this and ask if you have any questions and then go meet my new grandson.
Thank you very much and congratulations.
Pardon?
Congratulations on your new grandson.
I will wait till he's done.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman Beyer and Senate committee members. My name is Greg Bass. I am the Director of Regulatory and Legislative Affairs in the West for a company called Noble Americas Energy Solutions. I'm here in opposition to House Bill 4126, unless amended. A little bit about Noble Solutions. It's a San Diego-based electricity service supplier that has been actively serving commercial, industrial, and institutional customers in Oregon for over a decade in the Portland General and Pacific Corp service territories. Our customers are the grocery stores that you shop at, the hospitals that you rely upon for your health, the universities your children attend, and the cities in which you live. Through the landmark Senate Bill legislation 1149, direct access was created in the state of Oregon, and the electricity markets were opened to retail customers. We can offer our customers price savings, price certainty, and access to renewable energy of their choice. And it's this last item that has brought me here before you today. And before I proceed with my written testimony here, I just want, on a personal note, I just want to say it's always good to come to Oregon, regardless of the circumstances. And my wife and I have very, very fond memories of the time that we lived here in Oregon. And my oldest daughter's middle name is Rose, and she received that name in honor of the city to which she was born. Mm. House Bill 4126 could break a decade-long prohibition on the utilities being able to offer a customized generation portfolio to a select group of customers. Essentially, this bill is allowing investor-owned utilities to market products that the competitive marketplace currently offers. While this exemption for the investor-owned utilities, and I'm referring to Section 3, to be able to leverage their monopoly status to offer products that are currently available is disturbing, it is specifically Section 3, subsection 5, that could be used during the regulatory process to create confusion and potentially create an unlevel playing field between the investor-owned utilities and the electricity service suppliers. I'd like to use this hearing as an opportunity for Representative Smith to amend the bill and strike Section 3, subsection 5, and this potentially confusing language. I might also add in closing, and this is separate from the bill, but is an in general statement, that the investor-owned utilities don't need Section 3 of the bill to market renewable energy to a select group of industrial customers. They are more than welcome to establish an unregulated marketing affiliate business and compete head-to-head on a level playing field with Noble Solutions in the direct access market. Thank you for your time and your consideration, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, sir. I just note, though, reading the bill actually doesn't allow investor-owned utilities to offer anything. What it does is it authorizes the Public Utility Commission to conduct a study to consider whether they would do that.
That is correct. That is correct. I did take liberties on extrapolating where this would go.
A little difference there between authorizing the study and authorizing the rates to go forward. Thank you. Questions? Senator Rod.
Yeah, I just have a comment. There was comments made earlier. When something doesn't sound quite right to me, I check with elections. If one petitioner withdraws, the ballot measure still goes forward. It takes both of you to withdraw for the ballot measure to end. So I just want to clear that confusion that was from the Secretary of State's office. So
I apologize, and I did get that information from Mr. Cosgrove, and yeah. So it was apparently incorrect. What really I'd like to see is an amendment that refers this whole issue to the voters.
Well, I got to tell you, I kind of agree with you. It's been a sore spot for me that hydro and actually nitrogen technology, which is an advancement of hydro, is not part of the renewable energy in Oregon. And to me, a wind farm, it cracks me up. You go through the gorge and there's no wind farms, and the minute you pass a certain barrier, then there's wind farms all over the place. I just don't think that that's exactly more environmental than hydro. I just don't. So I sympathize highly, but this is, for me, I evaluate a bill if it's a step in the right direction. And it's sort of it's not a big step, but it's a step in the right direction. And so I think it's still a pretty good bill.
Okay. Well, Brush Canyon is going to go within a mile of the Wild and Scenic John Day, so we are going to be impacted in other areas.
Thank you very much, both of you. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on House Bill 4126A.
What? No amendments.
No amendments. No amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 4126A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
I agree with Senator Girard.
Do we need a roll call?
What part?
The part about this is a step in the right direction.
A step in the right direction. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 4126A is passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry. We'll close on that. We'll open a work session on House Bill 4045. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just gather my materials. House Bill 4045, we heard this a week ago today. The measure is the one that reconstitutes the Well Construction Contractors Continuing Ed Committee and statutory provisions related to continuing education programs for licensed well water constructors. It ratifies actions taken on or after January 7, 2014, and before the effective date of the measure has an emergency clause. We have since that time received two amendments. The first one was drafted by, was requested by committee staff at the request of the committee that sets a sunset for that for the reconstitution of the committee of January 2nd, 2022. And the second one, the Dash 2 amendment, we received yesterday. That amendment sunsets a measure on January 1st or 2nd, 2021. Those are essentially commensurate to the 6 year that we discussed at the last meeting. The Dash 2s also specify that the required number of continuing education credits may not exceed 7 credits and stipulates that if a Water Resource Commission rule requires more than 7 credits during specific licensing periods, then the applicant must obtain 7 credits during license period. Both of these amendments we have received fiscal and revenue impact statements. They both have minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair. The Water Resources Department is here if the committee has any questions about either of the amendments.
Thank you, Patrick. We are in work session. Senator Girard?
Yeah, I'm the author of the A2 amendments, and actually I think the A1 amendments, after talking with both parties, is probably the one we need to go with. Yeah. By setting in statute 7 credit hours, they have 2 requirements of 4 hours each, and the way current law is written, it allows them to come down from 14. 14 is the max under current law, and after talking with both parties, they're going to evaluate exactly how many they're going to need, and I would expect a reduction. And also one has a the A2s we set at January 1st, 21. The A1s is in, I think, 22. Actually, I think the 22 date's better because 21's a long session. If I had to do it over again, I would have put it in August of 21. So, in all honesty, whoever wrote the First Amendment, I think, did a better job.
In
transparency, who wrote the First Amendment?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
That was requested by your committee staff at the request that it was designed for a 6-year window. And if I can speak, Legislative Council was clear that that the general rule is that sunset should always happen on January 2nd of a year, that they don't like anything besides January 2nd as a sunset date. I don't know what the reason is, but that's the way they do it down there.
Yeah. Do I hear a motion?
Yeah, I move the Dash 1s.
Senator Girard has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4045. Discussion on that motion. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I thought of the same thing as Senator Girard. It makes sense to have the sunset at the end of a biennia, not at the beginning of a long legislative session. The 01 date would be at the beginning of a session. The 02, the 01 is basically after the long session is completed. So I support it.
So the discussion, Senator Edwards.
So could you summarize again what the dash ones do?
The dash one just puts a sunset for 2022. Sorry.
It doesn't change the hours or anything.
No, but the hours by law are not set at 14. They can go up to 14 in current law. So by talking with both parties, there's going to be a downward. They don't. I think it's come to an agreement that they probably need less than 14, but they need more than 7. So I'm expecting something in the middle.
And I think I've had a discussion with the department staff earlier today, and I think I conveyed the sense of the committee. You guys will tell me if I'm wrong, that we have a reluctance to have the creep of continuing education hours and believe that it's appropriate for agencies to set continuing education so that the regulated entities can live up to their licensure. But the stuff that goes beyond that, which we often describe sort of doing business better, while we endorse that that's good business practice, we're not going to legislate that. So we hope you hear the spirit of that. And as you deal with 4 to 14, you'll deal with that. Further discussion on the motion.
I guess my only other question is with the dash ones, is Senator Girard going to support the bill?
He moved it.
He might have moved the amendments, but that doesn't mean he's going to vote for the whole bill.
We'll find out in a minute.
I ask is because I like it without the sunset, so at all.
Oh, without the sunset.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that one is the compromise that will work today.
Okay.
Is there
That's
further,
all I need. That's the only cue I need.
Any objection? There's no objection. Is adopted, and I will note that the director of the department had said they could live with the sunset. Sir, you want to keep it on? You're on a roll.
Yeah, I move House Bill 4045 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved House Bill 4045 as amended by the dash one amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion?
I'll just discuss real quick for a second.
Discuss.
I called and talked to my local well driller and asked him about this whole idea of continued education and whether it made sense, whether it's too little, too much. And, he relayed to me that he thought it was valuable. He's been in the family business for all of his life. And, he said, you're going to have a certain number of well drillers in any, or a certain number of individuals at any time you have some of this kind of continuing education, they're going to grumble about it. And he talked about, he's well known to both the trade group and to the agency, but that there's an opportunity to engage and perhaps maybe ratchet it down a little bit. So I'm supportive of it based on those conversations.
Okay. Any other comments? Is there any opposition? House Bill
4045.
House Bill 4045, as amended by the dash ones, is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Girard, would you carry?
Sure.
We're done with that one, and we're done with our agenda for today, gentlemen.
Thank you again.
This is the last day. I think it's probably the last day we meet this session. What?
If I can point out, Mr. Chair, our committee assistant, Nicole, this is her last day in committee services. She was here for the short session, so I'd like to thank her for her work on the committee.
Thank you, Nicole. We really appreciate it, putting up with us and all of that. Kept us on time most of the time. That is started. Okay, so we are adjourned.
I heard a rumor that we're going to start.
Okay, so we are adjourned.